Chapter 30. Hollis. Miss Daly crossed the room and clapped her hands at Ben and Hollis. Ben bounced and clapped back.
"Ha ha, Miss Daly, you thought I wouldn't come today."
"Ha ha, Sir Ben," she said. "You can't fool me. I knew you'd be here."
"I'm the grill man and the guitar man."
Ben hugged his teacher around the waist, pinning her arms to her sides. She smiled at her own helplessness in his grip and rolled her eyes at Hollis. Suddenly done with his greeting, Ben released her and headed off, without a backward glance, to join a group of three girls sitting at a round table by the window. He pulled out a chair and tried to sit, but the back of the chair caught the bottom of his red Buckeyes backpack and tipped over with a racket. The girls laughed, and Ben threw his hands up in the air like he had crossed a marathon finish line.
"Hi, Hollis," Miss Daly said, laughing. "Nice to see you again."
"Likewise." Hollis bowed slightly at the waist. Ben shrugged his way out of his pack, letting it drop to the floor, and took his seat. A boy from a nearby table bellowed something Hollis could not understand, and all 10 children in the room laughed. Ben's hands went back up in victory, and two of the girls at his table clapped. They, too, had the high foreheads and flattened facial features, and the slanted eyes. Hollis knew that not everyone in the class had Down syndrome, and wondered idly about the grouping.
"All of them at his table are DS?"
"Yes," she said, looking back.
"Is that by design?"
"No, they're free to sit where they like." She smiled. "We all have the instinct to find ourselves in a crowd. They're no different."
"Hmm." Hollis nodded. "He sure found the girl table."
"Oh, yes, he's turning into quite a ladies' man," said Miss Daly.
"All the John's men have had that problem, I guess," said Hollis, shrugging. Miss Daly laughed. "It's a curse, really. Very inconvenient."
"I guess he'll learn to cope somehow," she said, playing along. Hollis took her in under cover of a smile and an unnecessary laugh. They had met only twice before. She was young and short, with large, compassionate brown eyes and a smallish mouth that had been almost over-equipped with sizable white teeth. That much of her reminded him of some agreeably inquisitive woodland creature. She had shiny blonde hair gathered in a barrette that fell to just below her shoulders. She wore a clean white cotton blouse and brown corduroys that flared over a pair of leather clogs.
"Sorry he's late," he said. "He got up a little late today."
Miss Daly raised her eyebrows.
"Okay, I got up a little late today. Boy, you sure don't miss a trick, do you?"
She laughed and then furrowed her forehead and wagged her finger. "Susan said I should expect something like this. I'm sure you'll be glad when she gets back."
Hollis did not know if it was Miss Daly's blonde hair or that she was now acting as Susan's proxy in scolding him, but he was reminded in some inexplicable way of his wife.
Perhaps it was simply the classroom setting with its low tables and the big desk up front between the chalkboard and the coat rack. Perhaps it was the smell of chalk dust. It was something, though, and whatever it was, it took him back. He remembered loitering in the hallways of Patterson Elementary, waiting for the door with his wife's name on it to open, and for swarms of fourth and fifth grade children to come stampeding out around him and then fade away down the hall. As he stepped into a room not quite like this one, but similar in a less structured way. That was back in Dayton, right after they were married, at least a couple of lifetimes ago.
"Oh, don't you two start ganging up on me now," said Hollis, pretending to be offended, taking his turn to wag a finger. "Benny and I do just fine on our own. Everything is under control. You two are in cahoots to make me look bad, that's all."
Miss Daly laughed. Hollis winked at her, and she laughed genuinely back at him. His chest cavity inflated a little, drawing his shoulders up and back. His abdominals tightened imperceptibly. It was all part of an autonomic flirting reflex over which Hollis really had no control. There was breathing, and there was circulation, and then there was this. His thumb sank down into his waistband and moved smoothly outward from his belt buckle, tracing the perimeter of his midsection like soldiers patrolling a circular trench around the general's command tent, deftly tightening the fabric as they went.
"Sure, you laugh," he continued. "You laugh, but I know how you teachers are."
"Oh, you do, do you?" said Miss Daly, crossing her arms beneath her breasts and shifting her weight playfully to one hip. This woodland creature, in addition to having a pleasantly curious look, also had some seriously pleasant curves. Hollis could see hints of the lace pattern of her brassiere. He felt the general stirring in his tent.
"Yes, yes, I do. I married one, so I have lots of experience. I know how you are."
"I see. And just how are we teachers?"
Hollis looked down at her, the chalk dust in the air filling his senses. Back in Dayton, they had lived in a small but very comfortable two-bedroom house. The neighborhood was wholly unrepresentative of their meager earning power, Susan as a new teacher and Hollis as a real estate agent, having trouble finding a successful rhythm with his third agency since graduating. The house had been a wedding present, given to them outright by Hollis's parents. His mother, Mary Ann, one of the great Benjamin Easley's eight children, had inherited a respectable sum when her father, the founder of Cincinnati Pulp Incorporated, finally succumbed to cancer of the colon. Homer Johns, who had charmed his way ass backward into the Easley family fortune, had thought the wedding gift of an entire house to be an overly extravagant gesture, repeatedly invoking the American Gothic-inspired memory of his parents, as well as his own anecdotally rich impoverishment as a young man. Homer had attempted to impress upon his wife the importance of making one's own way in the world. Bestowing an entire house as a gift was beyond the pale and sure to cause irreparable character damage. It was a credit to Homer that he did not allow his current circumstances to corrupt his bootstrap philosophy of living. Homer had, in fact, grown out of poverty, making his own way in the world. The fact that his way in the world got a whole lot easier when he married into a timber fortune did nothing to discredit the guiding ethic of his upbringing. But while the free house proved to be an enormously beneficial asset in future years, it did little to meet the early monthly expenses of Hollis's marriage. Susan's income was a steady but small teaching salary, and Hollis's contribution came in the form of unpredictable, sporadic commissions. Food, clothing, and utilities were challenge enough. The things they wanted but did not immediately need were extravagances. Wanting decent furniture, for instance, was on the same order as wanting a private yacht. Their free home stayed barren for the first 8 months of their marriage, save for a bed, a sturdy card table and folding chairs, two oversized yellow vinyl beanbags, a cork-covered plywood box they used as a coffee table, and a mishmash of wooden milk crate shelving they covered in fabric remnants to hold most of what they owned, including Hollis's old Fisher Hi-Fi and his oak-framed speakers, their treasured LPs, their books, framed photos of their respective families, a small black-and-white television, and lots of ceramic pots holding flowers and plants that thrived in the southern exposure and served remarkably well to obscure the infrastructure that supported their things. Ultimately, it was two visits from Mary Ann Easley Johns that fixed the furniture problem in very short order. One visit with Homer for Thanksgiving dinner, at which Mary Ann did little to conceal her distress at the stark disparity between the gifted house and its furnishings, and one visit shortly thereafter to take Susan shopping at the Living Spaces showroom in Columbus, when Homer was off in Florida fishing. Hollis had returned from work that evening to a beaming wife and a home in the chaos of mid-transformation. He had been simultaneously delighted that he would suddenly be living in a well-furnished home, befitting a successful man of business. Ashamed that he was not a successful man of business with the money to buy furniture for himself, embarrassed that he had not yet set the world afire as he had predicted to anyone who would listen, and, too, just a little worried that Susan and his mother were quickly bonding over an unchecked sense of entitlement to spend money without spousal approval. Rather than accepting the gift, Hollis had made a point of protesting his mother's extravagance. Marianne Easley Johns had listened to the tirade, unmoved, as she casually fussed with a new lamp and extracted brightly tasseled throw pillows from a bag, handing them to Susan, one after another, who laid them out where the new sofa and love seat would go. Then Marianne had replied with her characteristic brevity and sweet condescension, deliberately using his real first name just to get his attention.
"Leonard, keep that talk up and you will soon replace your father as the poorest man ever to live under a roof made of another man's money."
It had been a one-sentence argument ender, stinging Hollis to the very center of his pride. His only rejoinder before angrily stalking off had been to insist that she not call him Leonard. Hollis had taken to using his middle name once he started college, severing for good his high school identity as a gangly, well-spoken, bookish sort with few friends that were not on the chess team. Although he had been a gregarious and likable boy, the others attending Walnut High School had been put off by his intelligence and his interest in the grading curve and graduating at the top of his class rather than getting to second base with a girl. Any girl. Or indulging in the mania of sock hops and high school football. That, anyway, was how Hollis had come to understand the alienation of those years, and there was certainly some truth to that understanding. But he also knew that the family relations had not helped things one bit. Everyone at Walnut High had known the name of Benjamin Easley, just as they had known that Marianne Easley Johns had served on the school board for the Cincinnati Public School District for many years, including all 4 years of Leonard Johns' high school enrollment. And they had certainly heard of Marianne Easley Johns' highly public campaign to wrest employment away from Principal Davis over at Taft High School for alleged indiscretions involving one of his teachers. Marianne Easley Johns had claimed that Principal Davis's affair had clouded his judgment, persuading him to retain the teacher, who Marianne Easley Johns thought should be fired. The teacher in question, a Mrs. Finstrom, had felt free not only to instruct her students that Thomas Jefferson was an owner of slaves, but also to get into the whole awkward business about Sally Hemings. Since Marianne Easley Johns' school board campaign had quite proudly noted an upstream confluence of the Easley and Jefferson bloodlines, it was true that she felt somewhat obligated to defend her name. Nevertheless, it remained true that Principal Davis had been caught bare-assed in the band room with Mrs. Finstrom, whose contributions to the Walnut Hill curriculum were in the subjects of health, home economics, and the piccolo. Leonard had made the mistake of believing that his Jeffersonian Easley pedigree was simply proof that he was destined to live up to the Walnut Hills High School motto, Sursum ad Summum, which was Latin for rise to the highest. Leonard had not been a braggart, but neither was he inclined to hide from the fact of his connections. But rather than look reverently upon his family history, or even indifferently, Leonard's peers had rather decidedly held those connections against him. The name Leonard had quickly become a nasal-inflected Leonard, and then simply Nerd. He had been beaten up twice in his sophomore year, and once as a junior. None of these incidents inflicted any lasting physical damage, and all of them certainly would have occurred regardless of the name by which people knew him. But in Leonard's mind, just as in Hollis's memory, it was all about the name. Joining the swim team in his junior year had raised some eyebrows and even some respect when he had shown what he could do in the water at the state championships. But such successes had occurred far too late to alter his identity. People had made up their minds about Leonard Nerd. On the day of his graduation, as Leonard and Homer and Marianne listened to the valedictorian address given by one of many students who had finished with a higher grade point average than his own, others were busy soaping the windows of his car. Thomas Jefferson was a nerd. When he left home and moved away to the dormitories of the UNOH Fighting Dog Stars, Leonard had started introducing himself to others by his middle name. Those who did not know him, which was most people, had no reason to think of him as anyone other than Hollis Johns. Those few students who did know him either had not associated with him or had quickly overcome their initial confusion and adapted. And soon, even for those people,
He was just Hollis. Even his parents had accepted their son's preference for the most part, although Marianne occasionally delighted in reminding him of his given name. To her, Hollis would always be Leonard. Or, whenever she was particularly peeved and wished not only to control his name but also to revoke his identity as a mature adult, Leo. It had not been 30 seconds into Hollis's tirade about the new furniture that he had known his mother would do whatever she wanted to do, even if it was in his own house and involved the co-opting of his own wife in his emasculation as husband and provider. Marianne had called him Leonard to make a point. He was who he was, whether he liked that person or did not like that person. At that point in his life, Hollis was a person without the resources to purchase a chair that was not filled with beans and wrapped in vinyl. And, unless she wanted to sit on the floor in a pile of dried legumes, or sit at a card table, or lie down in bed, his poor wife had no place to sit down and relax after standing all day at the blackboard. Hollis did not have to like that fact, but he did have to accept it, just as he had to accept that his mother, unlike him, did have the resources to provide for his wife's comfort and would do so, no matter how much it might have wounded his pride. Had Hollis persisted in objecting, she would have progressed to calling him Leo. So he had stopped protesting and had wisely conceded the fight. Marianne had returned home the next day, kissing him on the cheek and leaving him with the humiliation of a well-furnished home and a comfortable wife. The house in Dayton was married in his memory to their only car of that era, a second-hand Volkswagen Beetle, baby blue with a large yellow daisy painted on the back. The car was technically Susan's, a holdover from her last year of college. Her parents had supplied the Beetle, Susan had supplied the Daisy. And, like her income as a teacher, it was reliable but very, very small. It was Hollis, however, who drove the Beetle during their years in Dayton, because it was Hollis who needed to be mobile in order to fulfill the demands of his profession. One simply did not take a bus to meet the prospective buyers of a brand new $30,000 home. Such did not inspire confidence. It may as well have been a rule, tested on the Ohio real estate exam. True, it was scarcely more inspiring, and perhaps less inspiring, to rattle up the driveway in a baby blue daisy-emblazoned Beetle that was so small relative to the shoulder girth of the driver as to conjure images of clowns disembarking beneath the big top. But, as Homer would say, one makes do in life as best one can. Hollis made do by always arriving early and parking a block away. Hollis found his parents' decision to purchase him a house rather than a second car fairly inexplicable, but hardly something he could have complained about. The opportunity had quite naturally presented itself when the white 1962 Plymouth Valiant he had driven all through college disappeared one night from its usual spot in the Kent State visitor lot, about a block from Susan's dormitory. Marianne, who had given him the Valiant after high school, might have sprung for a new car. But Hollis could almost hear his father lecturing his mother. "Just leave it be, Marianne, Christ Almighty. You've got a tit made of pure silver, but you will ruin him. Mark my words, like you have ruined me. Let the boy make his own way in the world. Taking the bus will do him some good." Whatever the reason, Marianne had apparently concluded that one free car was enough, and she was ready to move on, to real estate. The theft of the Valiant had produced sympathy and even some vicarious outrage, but no replacement. He might have asked his parents for a loan, but Hollis was, after all, the son of Homer, and he had an uncommon need to believe in his own self-sufficiency. The privilege of driving Daisy. Against Hollis's best efforts, Susan's pet name for her car had survived the nuptials and the changing of her own name, came with the regular responsibility of dropping Susan off at her school in the morning and picking her up in the afternoon. Hollis did so unfailingly and without complaint. He was almost always early at both ends of the day. He had resolved early on that he would not be one of those husbands a wife was able to use as an excuse for being late or for having a messy home or other perceived domestic shortcomings. Theirs was a partnership, and he was a full participant.
Dinner might be late to the table, but not because Hollis had failed to pick up the groceries on the way home. If they were surprised by visiting family or friends, any discomfort at the state of their home would not be due to a failure on Hollis's part to keep his clothes picked up, his dishes in the sink, and the lawn mowed. Hollis would, by God, keep up his end of things, and he would not be Susan's burden or her excuse. Not that Susan needed excuses, for while she was far more relaxed than Hollis about social perceptions and the general notion of domestic obligation, she had always carried her own water. She took pride in their marriage and in the life they made. What was important to Hollis was naturally and without reservation important to Susan. She worked hard, not just on her own priorities, chief among them the teaching of a new generation of Aquarians and volunteering at the Dayton County Pioneers Home, but also on his priorities, which included some regular demonstration to the world that he and his comely bride were exemplifying, rather than simply living, the American dream, as two physically beautiful specimens bound by a common, albeit distant, destiny of obscene wealth and enviable perfection in every way. That was Hollis's priority. That and learning the guitar. Any instrument might have done, but the guitar seemed particularly well-suited to his life plan. Their life plan. More affordable than a piano. Easier to learn than a violin. More substantial than a flute. It was an instrument that was easy to pick up in a casual way. Playing a few riffs as the dinner guests wander back into the living room with their after-dinner cocktails and speculate about what mood the market will be in next week. They would probably ask whether Hollis had any worries about his portfolio, or about whether Ohio real estate values were due for an adjustment, and he would simply smile and shake his head and play the notes of his unconcern. That was how he saw himself. And he could imagine that then Susan would appear, with offerings of dessert and coffee. And then someone in a suit would ask if she plays as well as her husband, and they would both look at each other and laugh. And she would take off her rings, and she would play something Spanish. And their guests would all smile and look at each other and shake their heads, as if to say, "I should have known." For Hollis and Susan were just the kind of people, and theirs was just the kind of marriage that one might easily expect to produce prodigious wealth and impressive talent under the same massive roof. A credible, soulful flourish on a well-worn six-string acoustic, Hollis believed, would tend to soften the sharper edges of financial achievement. An outlet for artistic expression would help guard against the garishness and shallow sensibility that came with the kind of success he courted, and to which he believed they were destined. Hollis believed that it was always the extracurricular pursuits, music, the arts, athletics, spirituality, philosophy, and casual command of the esoteric, that tended to make a person interesting, worth remembering. Such endeavors were steps along the path to personal deepening. Deepening. It was the same natural process of maturation and enrichment and mounting complexity that pulled thin alpine streams to the sea, that coaxed high adolescent voices into the chest, and that gave body and gravitas to young, freshly corked wines. The deepening was gravitational, directional, spiritual. Of course, artistic expression without artistic ability was out of the question. Embarrassment was not part of the plan, nor was pretension. The image in Hollis's head was not to be confused with the wandering musical posers that had overpopulated their college years. It was a genuine, finely honed talent he had in mind. Proficiency was key. It would take practice, and lots of it. But he could do that. They could do that. They were young and determined, and neither of them shied away from a challenge. If they simply practiced, if they devoted enough hours to sitting cross-legged in front of each other, mastering chord progressions and pick patterns, they would learn, and with time, their improvement would build on itself and would grow exponentially. It was an investment worth making,
an investment in him and in her and in them. For their first married Christmas together, Hollis purchased matching second-hand flat-top Guild acoustic six-string guitars and a tattered Simon & Garfunkel songbook. He signed them up for weekly lessons on Sundays at the First Methodist Church that was within walking distance of the house, and they attended without fail. They practiced for an hour and a half in the evenings, after Susan had cleaned and stacked the dishes, and after Hollis had taken out the trash, and before they both had gone to bed to make music of a different kind, and to talk in whispers about the dream of children and what they would name the babies when they came. If a boy, then he voted for Benjamin after his grandfather, Benjamin Easley, a man of fortitude, wealth, power, and great intelligence. She voted for David, ostensibly after the statue, but more likely, Hollis suspected, after David Crosby, whom Susan had been known to openly and ardently admire when she was young and stoned and awash in Aquarian groupies. If a girl, then Susan liked Matilda, after her great-grandmother. Matilda Leona was a woman of uncommon beauty, who had broken every rule of God, country, and family by walking out of an all but arranged marriage and a mysteriously burning Barcelona home, smuggling herself to America, and after many years of notorious independence as a teacher and a writer of women's stories, marrying a German-born farmer twice her age, growing corn and potatoes in southern Indiana. Hollis favored the name Cecilia because he liked the sound of it, and because it was the first Simon and Garfunkel song he learned to play, recognizably. Although Susan had endured enough bad guitar on the lawns of Kent State to last a lifetime, she had agreeably indulged her husband's musical ambition. The truth was, she was as helpless as anyone to resist the enthusiasm that Hollis had for being Hollis, which accounted for more than one half of their marital union. So she had practiced with him, night after night, he singing, she strumming, him picking, her humming, until their fingertips were calloused and hard, and they had tortured the sound of silence and American tune into rhyming, atonal confessions of a grave and earnest sin, the lyrics coming like sorrowful, broken, halting pleas, begging to disassociate themselves from the clamoring strings. Although learning the guitar had never been Susan's personal priority, it was a priority for Hollis that became, by extension, a priority of the marital union, and, by extension, once again, a personal priority of her own as a member of that union. That, as they say, was marriage, and Susan was a team player. She had taken to the instrument with gusto, soon surpassing Hollis in ability and, ultimately, in enthusiasm. Before Hollis's guitar was completely edged out of the living room and into the closet by his sudden and consuming passion for the more solitary artistry of darkroom photography, Susan had worked her way through Simon and Garfunkel and was tackling Neil Young. Susan's natural inclination to support the team, however, did not relegate her identity or esteem to the ranks of second-class membership. She had retained her feminist ideals. All of the causes that had animated her college years, the fundamental equality of the sexes, remained close to the core of her self-definition. The other passions in her life as a student radical, while never openly disavowed, tended to desiccate over time and fall away from lack of attention. Except, notably, her former interest in all injustices having to do with American foreign policy, which had not faded away over time. Instead, the Ohio National Guard had retired those particular passions rather abruptly. After that terrible day, she stopped talking about Vietnam and Cambodia altogether. Not because she had come around to Hollis's view of international politics, certainly not that, but rather because some combination of fear and psychological trauma and pain had kept her from picking up that particular banner. Out of respect and understanding, for he had been with her on that day, Hollis had generally let those issues go and did not spar with her on such matters. But Susan's belief in equality between the genders stuck with her. The cause of women remained a flashpoint for her anger, and her occasionally grandiloquent indignation as they read the Sunday newspaper, or drove to the market, or walked to their guitar lessons. "If you prick us, do we not bleed?"
If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, Hollis, if you suppress our wages and restrict our access to property and power, do we not bear your children and cook your meals and attend slavishly to the almighty appendage?
She did not, he knew, mean to implicate him personally in these tirades against his gender. He was not the enemy or part of the problem. He knew that. It helped to understand that Susan had a natural passion for reform. She saw herself as an agent of change. She needed to vent her anger, to rail, to be contrary. Emotion was part and parcel of what she had to say. She needed to believe that she knew what was best and what was wrong and why things were the way they were. And all that meant that he, Hollis, needed to let her have what she needed. He needed to be tolerant. He needed to listen and nod and to offer words of vague encouragement. Yes, and I agree, and of course, were usually his friends, at least if she did not choose to follow up. Sometimes a simple mm-hmm was all it took.
"They will bar the gates, Hollis,"
she had said of Shirley Chisholm one day from the bathroom as he was sitting on the bed, pulling on his socks.
"You mark my words, the party will block her way like she has the plague. And do you know why?"
Hollis had not answered her, partly because the subject was wearing thin, and partly because he knew that an answer on this issue was really just a form of conversational punctuation, allowing her to refill her lungs with oxygen. She had appeared in the doorway in her slip, braless, her breasts like large, perfect apples covered in fresh snow, and had pointed a foamy toothbrush at him accusingly.
"I'll tell you why. It's not because she's black. It's because she's a woman. This country will elect a black man long before it elects a woman of any race."
He had looked up attentively, or so he thought.
"It's true, Hollis. Don't roll your eyes. It's true. She has more courage and integrity and passion to really change this country than any of those yahoos. McCarthy? George Wallace? Edmund Muskie, for chiz sakes?"
Hollis knew better than to toss Dick Nixon into the conversation, so instead he had pulled on his other sock and nodded.
"She will go down in flames, because this country cannot stomach the very idea of a woman who is capable of leading men. The Joint Chiefs saluting abroad, that's the deal-breaker right there. This country could more easily see a Martian in the White House than a woman. A Martian with a penis."
Hollis's contribution had been to seriously doubt Martians actually had penises.
"Then they're out, too," she had responded, storming back into the bathroom. "No penis? Too much like a woman. No job for you. Vote McGovern. He has a goddamned penis."
Despite her pessimism, Susan was a tireless supporter of Shirley Chisholm's bid for the history books. It was not difficult for her to reactivate the network of friendships she had forged at Kent State and had loosely maintained since graduating. They were a group of 15 almost instantly, swelling to over 40 within a month or two of effort. They wrote to the Chisholm campaign and received position statements and boxes of buttons and posters that boldly announced things like "Catalyst for Change" and "Chisholm, Ready or Not" and "Ms. Chiz for Prez." They all joined the National Women's Political Caucus and spent hours every other weekend canvassing neighborhoods in Dayton and Toledo and Cincinnati and Columbus and Cleveland and hosting discussions on the need for an equal rights amendment and a path to the holy grail of a madam president. There were burnt offerings for Bella Abzug and Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. When it was Susan's turn to host, Hollis did what he could to help with the preparations, mainly cutting the grass and picking up the house and bringing the extra patio chairs out of storage and making sure the liquor was sufficiently stocked. But then he tried to make himself scarce after Susan's friends arrived. He had already put in his time around the campfire, singing Kumbaya. He could afford to support her without devoting the level of effort, the hands-on attentiveness, it had once taken to compete with her milieu and all the suitors for her affections. They were married now. She had chosen, and he had prevailed. Susan would still be there when the rallying stopped and her friends decided it was time to leave. so he felt free to help her set things up and then to simply disappear to the library, or the bookstore, or the office, while they plotted and schemed to help Miss Chiz reshape the country to their liking. And when he returned, he would help her pick things up and wash the dishes and put away the extra patio chairs, and she would give him the highlights of the evening, to which he listened with genuine interest, if not enthusiasm, and affirmed that she was making a difference. He knew Shirley Chisholm did not stand a snowball's chance in hell. So did Susan. But there was no point in rubbing her face in it. And if she found a personal satisfaction in fighting the good fight against an overabundance of testosterone in the halls of governance, then who was he to suggest that she was tilting at windmills? He was her husband, and her interests were his to support. Of course, this ethic of compassionate indulgence and marital egalitarianism was largely academic, requiring little more from Hollis than his attention and his restraint. There had been occasions, however, when Susan's gender politics had positioned Hollis's personal and professional lifestyle choices at the sharpened end of her opinions. Here, when she had seemed convinced that he was not an ally but part of the greater societal problem, he had found her more ferocious than adorably misguided. It had been difficult on these infrequent occasions for him not to feel a little put out that his unquestioning acceptance of her opinions was not to be reciprocated, and that his tolerance would be met with intolerance. But Hollis had relearned many times that once fully engaged on an issue, Susan tended to dig in and was not easily convinced or dissuaded from the fight. She had been unmoved, for instance, by his careful and almost scholarly explanation of the importance of marketing and networking in the selling of real estate. If the big property buyers, the commercial players, spent time playing golf, then the real estate sellers also needed to spend time playing golf. And that meant him. Even if that meant partaking in his firm's membership to the Lakeland Golf and Country Club, a venerable but, yes, exclusively men's establishment. He had explained to her that sellers who let their personal opinions and politics interfere with business did not usually sell very much real estate, and they tended not to make a name for themselves in the circles where the real business was conducted. He knew the real estate market. She did not. He had an agency to answer to and owners to impress. She did not. He, not she, had a business career to build, and if that meant occasionally playing the back nine at Lakeland and then having cocktails at the Buckeye Sundown Show Club and Gentleman's Lounge, then that is simply what it would take. But Susan had been unmoved and unmovable, and in the end, she had buried him in such an avalanche of shame and civic moralizing that he gave up trying to convince her, resolving instead that there was really no reason he had to inform her of the specific golf courses and eating or drinking establishments at which he felt obligated to cater to the preferences of his clients. He stopped telling, and she stopped asking, and the issue fell into the limbo of a quiet, uncomfortable truce. Hollis's subscription to Playboy magazine had been another memorable point of contention. Susan was not a feminist taken in by the Hugh Hefners of the world. She knew the difference between sexual independence and sexual subjugation, the former entailing a measure of personal control of one's body and sexual expression, and the latter entailing the bartering of one's physical integrity for male approval. Notwithstanding the efforts of Mr. Hefner and an adolescent-minded, male-centric American culture to blur the distinction, Susan knew the difference between a woman who burns her bras and a woman who is paid by men to bear her breasts. Playboy was not a pictorial of feminine independence. Nor was she inclined to accept Hollis's insistence that Playboy offered sophisticated satirical humor and intriguing political analysis.
"It's exploitative," she had insisted. "It's candy-coated misogyny is what it is."
Hollis had argued that the magazine exalted women, not hated them. It idolizes them. Susan had countered that it objectifies women and thereby dehumanizes them, and that maybe Hollis did not fully appreciate the more insidious and subtle forms of sexism. Hollis had then made the mistake of suggesting that maybe Susan had simply internalized her mother's prudish sensibilities. it had not gone over well. Prude? Leonard Hollis Johns, you know damn well I'm no prude. She had, back then, taken to calling him by his full name whenever she was angry. It was an effective way of summoning the spirit of his mother and of taking a good 10 or 20 years off his self-confidence. I'm as open about sex as anyone you'll ever find. My mother would never speak to me again if she knew about all the sex I've had in my life. Sex is good. Nudity is good. Hell, Hollis, I think public nudity is good. The world would probably be a much safer place if everyone were nude. But splaying 18-year-old girls in Technicolor for the lurid enjoyment of dirty old men is not good, Hollis. Not good. She sure had him there. Hollis had not dared argue with Susan's free-love hippie credentials. Wherever she may have chosen to draw the line between the mere advocacy of making love not war and the actual practice of making love not war, it was by then purely an issue of history that Hollis did not particularly care to investigate. He was comfortable in his belief that for all her talk and counterculture chest-beating, Susan had loved him and only him, desired him and only him, and that when they had periodically separated, she, like he, had chastely waited for their inevitable reunion. Sure, she had frequently left him wondering. She had intentionally fomented some concern that she might move on without him, even that she had moved on without him, and that there were plenty of men out there who could keep her satisfied. And Hollis had even fallen for it now and then. More than once he had reconciled sooner than he otherwise would have, just to hedge his bets that she was bluffing. But Hollis had known, he had been reasonably sure anyway, that the stirring up of such uncertainties was all just part of playing the dating game. When it came right down to the truth of things, Hollis believed Susan had more of her mother in her than she liked to admit. Nancy Kimball, the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, was a woman who knew the virtues of fidelity and commitment, and she and her husband had raised a good girl. Smart and independent-minded, but good. So Hollis was fairly confident that he could dismiss Susan's free-love alter ego as a culturally inspired conceit. Just the same, Hollis had not been interested in pursuing the Playboy argument so recklessly into the past. He had not felt good about forcing her to wake the dead to disprove her goodness. Let the dead sleep, he had thought. So he had shoved the Playboy argument in the opposite direction. I'm not a dirty old man, Susan. You are so inflammatory sometimes. I do not masturbate to these women. She had looked at him with an infuriating expression of restrained disbelief. I don't. She had put her hands up in an if-you-say-so gesture, demonstrating her unwillingness to stoop to fight him on the issue. Hollis had been relieved. But then Susan had added that it was just so very curious that he felt compelled to save each issue in a collection that he kept in a cabinet beneath the bathroom sink. You won't allow them anywhere else in the house, Susan. Besides, he had shouted, I do a lot of reading in the bathroom. And hey, I've got to put up with your little peace pipes, your little bongs, your little bowls of Mary Jane. You want to talk about that? Is that something you teach those kids about? Susan had shown hurt and anger on her face, but was not to be distracted. Icily confessing to being unable to decide which was more ridiculous, the idea of using the toilet as a library, or someone actually reading pornographic magazines. It's got some of the best political writing you'll find anywhere. It was a point that had been easy for Hollis to make because he genuinely believed it to be true. Although, when Susan asked why he chose to throw away issues of Rolling Stone rather than squirrel them away beneath the sink with the treasure trove of political discourse, he had not had a good answer, except to proclaim that there was just not nearly enough room under there for both publications. He had made another push to prove that Playboy was a publication of political substance by retreating to the bathroom and finding the edition that featured an interview with Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Herbert that he had, in fact, by God, read entirely on the toilet. You should approve, Susan, he said, almost pleadingly. They print it all.
The looting, the executions, the rapes and murders, all the war crimes he brought to light. If Anthony Herbert chooses Playboy magazine to expose the atrocities of the Vietnam War, then why shouldn't we be reading about it? Are you saying you and your friends can broadcast the same goddamn atrocities on megaphones and great big cardboard signs and stir up all that trouble? But if Playboy magazine wants to do it in a way that millions of people will actually...
But Hollis had stopped in mid-sentence as he watched his wife's face turn almost instantly to stone, and the tears had welled up, deepening over her eyes, and it had been as if she were looking up at him through still water. He realized he had gone too far. He had tried to apologize, quickly, with enough force that she might not disappear into the abyss of memory, diving into the past and grabbing her beneath the arms and swimming for both of them, kicking hard, pulling her to the shore of the present.
"Susan, I'm sorry," he had said, grabbing her and wrapping his powerful arms around her shoulders.
I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking. I got carried away. Wasn't your fault. Say something. There was no way you could have known."
But she had not spoken, and she had not moved, and he had stood in their tiny kitchen, embracing a cold, weeping stone. He let go and stood back and bent forward just enough to look directly into her drowning blue eyes.
"They each made their own decision to be there, Susan," he had said, and for a moment he feared that she would continue as stone. But then she had blinked, and she had pushed him hard in his barrel chest and slapped at him violently, screaming at him in painful rage.
"They were all my friends, every last one of them. They were there because of me, Hollis, me, not you, certainly not you. You keep your fucking magazines, you keep them.
But don't you talk to me about that ever again."
The argument had destroyed the evening and all the next day. Susan had returned fully to the present, only gradually. She had wept her apologies for striking him, and he had assured her that he had deserved that and more. He had kissed her and stroked her hair, and they had made love right there in the living room. Within a week's time, they were back to normal. Back to perfect. As a gesture of remorse, Hollis had promptly unsubscribed to Playboy and mailed in a subscription to Ms. Magazine instead. He had also purged the bathroom cabinet beneath the sink, heaping a dozen magazines dramatically into the kitchen trash, and, in a far less dramatic, indeed wholly undetected manner, he had relocated four of the most interesting issues to a box of junk in the top of the bedroom closet. Susan had insisted that the gesture was unnecessary, and that she felt like she had won the concession unfairly, even granting her consent to reactivate the subscription if he so desired. But the adoring look and the humor had fully returned to her eyes, and that had been all that mattered to Hollis.
"I'm quite satisfied, thank you, jerking off to the political commentary of Rolling Stone." And they had laughed and kissed and carried on as ever before. Perfect. Hollis had tried, above all else, to be a reliable presence for his wife. He wanted to be counted on, trustworthy, a granite colossus to cling to in the high tide of worry, against which to smash the moments of hatred and frustration, upon which to climb for a better view of the horizon. He wanted to be as devoted to Susan and to her career and to her needs as he was to himself. And he wanted her never to doubt that he always had her best interests at heart, whatever his mistakes. If her well-being had meant conceding the fight, then he would want nothing more than to concede the fight. He had wanted to be reliably devoted to her and to them, the perfect couple. And now, looking back, he believed that he had been. He had been that granite colossus. He had been reliable in every respect, large and small. Among many other things, that meant he had dutifully shuttled Susan to and from Patterson Elementary every single workday in the cartoonish, daisy-emblazoned Volkswagen Bug that, for the sake of his career, she had fully ceded to his control. It had meant that he started his day later than he would have liked,
and that he needed to schedule his appointments around the mid-afternoon pickup. As inconvenient as these detours had been, they were, in the scheme of things, minor burdens well worth bearing. No wife of Hollis Johns would be riding public transportation anywhere if he had anything to say about it. And he certainly had something to say about it. They were a team. He would hold up his half and then some. He would have her to school on time in the mornings, and he would be there promptly at 2:30 to take her back home. And if he had to wait outside her door in the tiny hallway of Patterson Elementary for her to finish teaching class, then he did so. And he did so happily. And when the door opened and the children burbled out around him, like a torrent of multicolored soda water, he had peered into the classroom and looked at his new wife, the woman for whom he had bided his time and for whom he had waited with such single-minded desire, hoping against hope that the turbulence of those times would not catapult her in directions so radical or unseemly as to wrest her from his affections. And there she would be, sitting behind her big wooden desk, or with her back to him, erasing the chalkboard. And he would send out a silent intention of gratitude to whatever divine force had kept them together. Often Hollis had not announced himself, choosing instead to stand quietly in the doorway, watching, marveling, letting the reality of their new relation fill him. None of her hippie brigade had thought it would last. Not one of them. But Hollis had been patient. He had held on loosely so that she would not feel trapped, and he had been patient and he had proven all of them wrong. They had all wanted her for themselves. They had all loved her. They would all have followed her anywhere. And yet, miracle of miracles, she had followed him. And he had survived them all. She had survived the drugs and the free love and the cult of Aquarius and the mind-numbing scourge of untethered idealism. She had survived the bullets and the shattering of ideals among the flesh and blood and splintered bone. She had crossed the desert of the great cultural divide for him, and he had been waiting on the other side. And now she was his and he was hers, and there she stood, cleaning the blackboard or sitting behind her big teacher's desk, waiting for him to pick her up and take her home to the place where they lived. And when, at last, she would turn or look up and see him leaning in the doorway in his starched white shirt and one of his ridiculous ties and the shoes she had shined the night before, she would smile in the way she had always smiled, and her entire presence would radiate a sense of utter well-being. Hollis knew he was only partly responsible for her satisfaction. There was, after all, the teaching and the students to factor in. But he understood that somehow, his mere presence in the doorway of her life had completed that satisfaction. And now, here he was, standing in a different classroom, looking at a different teacher. Time threatening to collapse around him like a house of cards.
"I see. And just how are we teachers?" asked Miss Daly.
"Oh, you're a bossy, treacherous lot," said Hollis, not looking at her breasts. The left one, or the right one. "And you're thick as thieves." He winked and patted her on the shoulder, not lingering. "But you're also wonderful with my son, and he sure loves you, and since Ben's the best judge of character I know, you're okay in my book." She laughed, patting his hand. Her skin felt smooth and warm to the touch. "I'll be by to pick him up after school," he said. 2:30 sharp. "And tomorrow, I'll be on time."